Hi everyone, this is Andrei. Welcome to Post-Soviet Chronicles, a podcast on the recent history and politics of the former Soviet Union region. As always, I'd like to ask you to please support this podcast by giving it 5 stars and following it on your preferred streaming platforms. If you'd like to make sure you never miss an episode and receive additional subscriber-only content, you can also subscribe for free via email on postsovietchronicles.com/subscribe. If you like shorter content in a video format, you can also follow the show on Instagram and TikTok. The handle is postsovietchronicles. This is the second part on Yevgeny Prigozhin, the man behind the Wagner private military company, who was also known as Putin's chef. If you're new to this podcast, please consider listening to part one, which covers Prigozhin's life outside of his involvement with Wagner Group. I spoke about his youth and time in prison, his various businesses and lucrative government contracts, as well as his role as Putin's man for dirty work. In this episode, we will talk about the most famous example of such work, which is the formation and management of the Wagner private military company. This group of mercenaries, widely known for their brutality, participated in conflicts on Russia's behalf across the Middle East, Africa, and in Ukraine. After Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, they were deployed to help the crumbling regular Russian forces in their offensive. But the relationship between the Wagner mercenaries and the Russian Ministry of Defense gradually soured, and their conflict became very public. This eventually resulted in Prigozhin's unsuccessful attempt to march his mercenaries on Moscow in June 2023, after which he, unsurprisingly, died in a not-so-suspicious plane crash. So, what's the story behind the Wagner Group? How did Prigozhin end up with his own private army? And what led him to essentially start a military coup that eventually cost him his life? Let's talk about it in this episode. To track the roots of the Wagner Group, we actually need to forget about Prigozhin for a moment. We need to go back to 2013, when two Russians founded a private military company in Hong Kong called Slavonic Corps Limited. The purpose of this company was to address the needs of the Syrian president Bashar Assad to protect Syrian oil production and transportation facilities while the country was in the middle of a bloody civil war. The company then recruited over 250 Russian volunteers and appointed a former Russian foreign military intelligence officer, Dmitry Utkin, as their leader. Aside from his role at the Foreign Military Intelligence Service, Utkin also happened to be a neo-Nazi, based on his multiple Nazi tattoos. He also allegedly enjoyed the music of Richard Wagner, the famous German composer whose work was admired and appropriated by the Nazis. And as a result of his appreciation of this composer, Wagner became Utkin's military alias. In 2013, Utkin and all the other newly recruited mercenaries of the Slavonic Corps arrived in Syria. But from the very start, things didn't go well for them. Very soon, they basically realized that they weren't there to protect the oil production facilities, but actually fight for them on behalf of the Syrian government. They also didn't get any of the equipment they had been promised, and very soon after their arrival, they got ambushed by ISIS fighters. They managed to miraculously escape with minimal losses, but one of the mercenaries dropped his Russian passport during the escape. The story then got out to the media, and it soon became widely known that Russians were fighting in Syria. After this failed mission that they didn't even manage to start properly, they were promptly evacuated to Russia, where they were all arrested. And while all of the mercenaries were quickly released, the two original founders of the Slavonic Corps were actually imprisoned. They were convicted of the formation of mercenary forces, which, believe it or not, remains illegal in Russia, even till this day. Now, the motivation of the two convicted founders of the Slavonic Corps is not exactly clear. It may have just been the prospects of earning a lot of cash from the Syrian government, but it is also possible that they had been encouraged to initiate this little adventure by someone at the very top of Russia's security apparatus. This would probably be the Russian Foreign Military Intelligence Agency, known as the GRU. At the end of the day, the involvement of Utkin, a former GRU officer, seems like an interesting coincidence, at the very least. But even if the GRU was not directly involved in the formation of the Slavonic Corps, they certainly really liked the idea and had plans to create a similar fighting force of their own. According to a Russian investigative outlet Novaya Gazeta, at the start of 2014, the GRU was forming a special military force that would conduct operations abroad on behalf of Russia without the direct involvement of the country's armed forces. This would basically allow Russia to get militarily involved in other countries without formally admitting its presence there and without facing potential political and diplomatic repercussions. The man in charge of this task was Alexei Dumin, at the time deputy head of the GRU and Putin's former bodyguard. He reportedly contacted Utkin shortly after the latter's arrival from Syria and offered him to lead this new unofficial formation. Utkin was quickly able to gather almost all the mercenaries of the Slavonic Corps who had fought with him in Syria. They became the backbone of this military organization that was eventually named after their leader's military alias, Wagner. In February 2014, according to Novaya Gazeta, Dumin introduced Utkin to Prigozhin, who agreed to become sort of a civilian manager of the Wagner Group, taking care of its organizational tasks and internal processes. Was it possible for Prigozhin to refuse this offer? Who knows? But it is quite likely that this was the price he had to pay for all those huge government contracts that I spoke about in part one of this episode. It was probably not a coincidence that the Wagner Group was formed at the start of 2014. This was the year of Russia's military intervention in Ukraine, and the mercenaries were likely being prepared for this operation. To give you a little more context, in late February 2014, following months of the Euromaidan protest in Ukraine, the pro-Russian president Yanukovych was removed from office and fled to Russia. Shortly after that, masked soldiers without insignia, also known as the Little Green Men, suddenly appeared in Crimea. They took over its military bases and parliament and occupied the peninsula. Russia initially denied its military involvement, claiming the Little Green Men were some local militias standing up to the new pro-European government in Kyiv. This was obviously a lie, which was admitted by Putin himself a couple of months later. But what's interesting is that the mercenaries from the Wagner Group were spotted among the Little Green Men in Crimea, alongside units from the GRU and from various Russian special forces. Very soon after the events in Crimea, Russia-backed separatists took over parts of the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine and declared the People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. The Ukrainian military then launched its operation to gain back control over these regions, and that's how the full-fledged war broke out in the east of Ukraine. By the end of 2014, the Wagner Group became one of the most effective fighting forces on the pro-Russian side. They participated in some of the key battles, including the ones for the Donetsk airport and Debaltseve, a strategic region connecting the cities of Donetsk and Luhansk. In September 2015, Russia launched another foreign military intervention, this time officially and in Syria, in support of the government of Bashar Assad. And while the regular Russian army engaged primarily in extensive airstrikes across Syria, targeting Assad's opponents, the Wagner Group was used for military operations on the ground. At first, they seemed to have been very successful, particularly in recapturing significant oil and gas facilities from ISIS, Syrian opposition forces, and other Assad's adversaries. In exchange for recapturing these facilities, Prigozhin's companies would allegedly often receive a share in their production and profit. Aside from the financial backing by the Russian state, such deals with the Syrian government were believed to generate significant profits for the Wagner Group and Prigozhin. Their most famous military success in Syria happened in 2016, when they participated in the first Palmyra offensive. This was an operation to recapture a strategically important Syrian town near the ruins of the ancient city of Palmyra from the Islamic State. While this was officially an operation of the Syrian army, supported by the Russian aviation, It has been reported that the Wagner Group played a key role in the success of the ground offensive. After Palmyra was recaptured, the leadership of the Wagner Group was invited to the Kremlin. They were secretly awarded their Hero of Russia medals and took a photo with Putin. The photo was later leaked to the press and became very famous, mainly in the context of Putin awarding the highest honorary title to the reported neo-Nazi Utkin and then claiming to be fighting the mythical Nazis in Ukraine. Ironic, isn't it? Aside from their reputation as a relatively effective fighting force, Wagner also became known for their war crimes and brutality. In 2017, they recorded themselves torturing a Syrian man, whom they accused of being an ISIS fighter. They eventually crushed his head with a sledgehammer, mutilated his body, and set it on fire. The use of a sledgehammer later became their signature execution style, especially for the deserters. It also became one of the official symbols of their organization, but we'll come back to this a bit later. Nobody was ever prosecuted for their war crimes because, as far as the Russian state was concerned, the Wagner Group didn't exist. This allowed the Wagner mercenaries, and by extension the Russian government, to avoid responsibility and to essentially do whatever they please without any serious consequences. But it also meant that if something would go wrong for the Wagner Group, they couldn't always count on the Russian state to back them up. And this is exactly what happened in February 2018. Wagner was tasked to capture an oil or gas facility in eastern Syria, which was controlled by US-backed local forces. But what Wagner probably didn't know was that US Special Forces were actually also stationed at the facility at the time of the offensive. So when the US Army saw Wagner approaching the facility, they called up their Russian counterparts to check whether they were Russian soldiers. The Russian Ministry of Defense reassured them that they didn't operate in the area and that the mercenaries had absolutely nothing to do with them. So the US Air Force hid the approaching Wagner with all they had, completely obliterating them. It is estimated that over 200 mercenaries, most of them Russian citizens, were killed by the Americans on that day. By the way, this was the first direct military clash between American and Russian forces in history, even though the Russians remained unclaimed by the Russian Defense Ministry, who essentially left them there to die. The incident was so damaging, it almost led to the end of the Wagner Group. However, Prigozhin somehow managed to persuade Putin that the mercenaries could still be useful and sold him an idea of operating the Wagner Group in Africa. Soon after that, they started appearing in various African countries, including Sudan, Libya, Mozambique, and the Central African Republic. In 2018, three independent Russian journalists traveled to the Central African Republic to investigate the Wagner Group's activities there. On the third day of their trip, they were found dead. The official version, promoted by the Russian Foreign Ministry, was that they were victims of an armed robbery. At the same time, it was reported that none of their personal belongings were stolen, apart from their mobile phones. This sent shocks throughout the Russian media circles, and a number of independent Russian media outlets embarked on a journey to investigate their murder. The story that they uncovered was quite chilling. They found out that before their trip, the three journalists came into contact with another Russian reporter with experience in Africa. He recommended a fixer called Martin, who was supposed to help them with their work on the ground. The fixer, who would only communicate with them via messages, provided them with a driver and asked them to meet him in the middle of the night. On their way to this meeting, their car was stopped, they were dragged out, tortured, and eventually shot point blank. The journalistic investigation was able to connect their murder to the Wagner Group. First of all, the fixer called Martin never actually existed. And the Russian reporter who had initially helped them find the fixer turned out to be Kirill Romanovsky, an employee of Prigozhin's media outlet. But he wasn't just a Prigozhin-sponsored journalist. He was Prigozhin's close ally and confidant, as confirmed by Prigozhin himself. In 2023, when Romanovsky died after a prolonged illness, his book was released called 8 Years with Wagner, which confirmed his close affiliation with the mercenary group. So, having accepted Romanovsky's help, the journalists were walking into a trap set up by Wagner. After their arrival in the Central African Republic, their driver, who escaped completely unharmed, by the way, called the representatives of the Wagner group several times, presumably taking instructions. The evidence identified by independent Russian media left no doubt about who was behind the killing of the three journalists. But as with any crimes committed by Wagner, Russian authorities stood by their initial absurd version of an armed robbery and did not investigate it any further. The mercenaries continued to operate across Africa and the Middle East, supporting local regimes or forces that, in one way or another, appeared friendly towards the Russian government. Prigozhin would sign contracts with the local governments or warlords, helping them to quell protests, provide personal security, train their forces, but also run disinformation campaigns against their opposition, which is something he knew very well how to do. In exchange, they would get lucrative business deals, which mostly included access to natural resources. So, as you can see, their business model in Africa was very similar to the one in Syria. According to the Financial Times, between 2018 and 2022, Prigozhin derived over $250 million just from the natural resources in Africa and the Middle East. So, he was doing pretty well for himself. But in February 2022, Russia started its full-scale invasion of Ukraine and things changed. Russian army invaded Ukraine, expecting to capture Kyiv in the matter of days. As we all now know, it was a remarkable failure and the Russian army started taking way more losses than they'd anticipated. It became clear that the more regular Russian soldiers Putin sent to die to Ukraine, the harder it would be to justify this war to his supporters in Russia, especially with prospects of a potential full mobilization. And so they decided to call up Prigozhin and the Wagner group, who were quickly deployed to the bloodiest parts of the front by the end of March 2022. Wagner, once again, proved itself as a very effective fighting force. For their help with Russia's offensive, Putin even awarded Prigozhin the Hero of Russia medal. I have to say, though, their military successes were largely a result of their not very sustainable strategy of advancing, essentially regardless of losses. As you can imagine, they could only use this tactic for so long before they too were in dire need of a big wave of new recruits. And that's when Putin granted Prigozhin an unprecedented exclusive right to start recruiting Russian prisoners. In summer 2022, Prigozhin would start going around Russian prisons, promising the convicts freedom in exchange for 6 months of their service with Wagner. The only catch was that the survival rate in this meat grinder, especially for the prisoners, was obviously incredibly low. But I guess when you offer prisoners freedom, especially when they're locked up for a long time, they're willing to take the risk. Just in 2 months, Prigozhin managed to recruit over 20,000 prisoners, and by January 2023, this number may have risen to up to 50,000. I guess the Russian state thought this was a genius idea. By recruiting the prisoners through Wagner, Putin would get the much-needed additional troops without having to start a mass mobilization or take any responsibility for their countless deaths. At the end of the day, from the cynical perspective of the Russian state, they were all convicts, and not that many people would miss them or look for them if they died. And so it wasn't really a problem to use these convicts as cannon fodder against the Ukrainian army. But while their survival rate was generally quite low, some of them still made it out alive and received the presidential pardon no matter what kind of crimes they had committed. Mind you, for the war in Ukraine, Wagner specifically sought to recruit people who were involved in violent crimes such as murder and armed robbery. They also didn't really shy away from recruiting those convicted of things like rape and even cannibalism. And when some of them actually managed to survive the meat grinder for 6 months, they were pardoned personally by Putin. Unsurprisingly, we have since seen multiple instances of these convicts returning home and committing horrendous crimes. As you can see, in today's Russia, there's basically this new reality in which people who expose Putin's corruption and criticize his war in Ukraine get locked up or killed, while convicted rapists and cannibals have a chance to walk free. As the war in Ukraine went on, Prigozhin started cultivating an image of a military commander, always wearing camouflage and being close to the front line. He became so confident that in autumn 2022, he started to openly criticize the Russian defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, blaming him for Russian army's high number of losses. He then finally came clean, openly admitted he was behind the Wagner Group, and even opened a skyscraper in St. Petersburg, which he called the Wagner Center. Please remember, this is all happening while private military companies are still illegal in Russia. But Prigozhin didn't care. He was above the law. He could do whatever he wanted. He was so confident that he allowed his mercenaries to release a video of a brutal execution of one of their recruited convicts for desertion. In their signature style, they smashed his head with a sledgehammer and published the video online. Not only there was no official investigation into this matter, but some mainstream Russian politicians actually cheered Wagner's brutality. The chairman of a Russian puppet opposition party, Sergei Mironov, posed in pictures and videos with a sledgehammer after the incident, showing his support to Wagner. And top representatives of the Russian ruling party, United Russia, started threatening people they didn't like with the sledgehammer treatment. So the so-called Russian political elite essentially normalized brutal executions and extrajudicial killings as if it wasn't a crime at all. Prigozhin also started gaining popularity among certain parts of the Russian society. He particularly appealed to those who supported the war but were upset with the Russian army's failures and slow advances. Prigozhin's growing popularity made him believe that he could leverage it to gain real political power and influence within Putin's regime. At the end of the day, this was something he truly lacked. As I mentioned in part one of this episode, when he tried to take down Alexander Beglov, the governor of St. Petersburg, he failed miserably. Not only he failed, he also ruined his relationship with prominent members of Putin's presidential administration who backed Beglov in this conflict. So, Prigozhin really wanted to finally come out of the shadows and become a full, recognized member of Putin's elite. And then he found what he thought was his ticket to big politics. It was the Ukrainian town of Bakhmut, which the Russian army struggled to capture for months, even though its soldiers significantly outnumbered the Ukrainian defense forces. At the end of 2022, Prigozhin took over this part of the front. He probably believed that capturing this town would bring him the recognition he needed to kickstart his political career. His political ambitions were often discussed by the domestic and international press, but it wasn't just the media who noticed them. It finally occurred to someone in the Kremlin that giving a former criminal with sadistic tendencies an army of professional soldiers and dozens of thousands of prisoners might not be the best of ideas. And in February 2023, he was suddenly ordered to wrap up his recruitment of prisoners. Russian Defense Ministry then started recruiting them directly into the Russian army without Prigozhin's involvement, depriving him of his main source of manpower. The Russian military also started to decrease the supply of ammunition to Prigozhin's forces, which was another significant blow to Wagner. Despite these obstacles, Prigozhin became completely obsessed with Bakhmut. He wanted to capture it so badly, he even allegedly offered to provide the Ukrainian intelligence with information on the location of the Russian forces in exchange for Ukraine's withdrawal from this town. When this alleged deal didn't materialize, Prigozhin pressed on. He aimed to capture Bakhmut by the 9th of May, which is celebrated as the Victory Day in Russia and so has a significant symbolic value. And as this deadline was nearing, Prigozhin grew increasingly impatient with the Russian Ministry of Defense, which by the start of May allegedly completely stopped supplying him with ammunition. That's when he published videos publicly insulting the leadership of the Russian army, the defense minister Sergei Shoigu and the army chief Valery Gerasimov. He blamed them for Wagner's losses and claimed they were trying to destroy the group by not giving them enough ammunition. His angry videos, where he's shouting and swearing, looking absolutely deranged, became a classic and provided a lot of material for countless Prigozhin memes.
У нас нехватка боеприпасов 70%! Шойгу! Герасимов! Где боеприпасы?
Many people mistakenly thought that if Prigozhin is able to publicly curse at the country's top military officials, he must really be completely untouchable and possibly even have Putin's backing. But in reality, Prigozhin was finding it increasingly difficult to reach Putin, and this was essentially his cry for help. Since he was unable to communicate with Putin directly anymore, he tried to get his attention through the media. He also threatened to withdraw from Bakhmut completely, essentially blackmailing the Russian army. I guess this proved to be somewhat effective, at least in the short term, because he managed to get the ammunition he needed to eventually capture Bakhmut at the end of May. Once Bakhmut was captured, Prigozhin's main mission in Ukraine was now complete, so Wagner withdrew from the front line and transferred the control of the city to the Russian army. But his public humiliation of the country's top army officials really didn't sit well with Russia's political elite. And even those officials who had been very supportive of Prigozhin, like the Chechen president Ramzan Kadyrov, for example, turned away from him. Prigozhin made the situation even worse when he gave several very honest interviews after capturing Bakhmut, in which he once again criticized Russia's army leadership for being corrupt and useless. Apart from that, he essentially implied that the entire war was senseless because Ukraine and NATO never actually posed any military threat to Russia. And in the context of the constant lies on Russian TV, these statements sounded refreshingly honest, even when coming from someone like Prigozhin. And for many Russians, Prigozhin suddenly became this truth-teller and the man of the people, even though he was literally the most typical corrupt Putin-era oligarch you could possibly imagine. He then went on a tour across multiple Russian cities where he hosted a series of talks with the public. The formal reason for this was to promote his new media project, but it looked and sounded very much like a political campaign, appealing to the hardcore supporters of the war. He called for a mass mobilization and spoke about the need to reinstate the death penalty, especially for the corrupt army officials. Many people started thinking that he was planning to run for president. Not to actually challenge Putin, but possibly as one of his puppet candidates to gather votes from the hardliners that, believe it or not, thought Putin was too soft on Ukraine. It is also possible that Prigozhin wanted to start his own political movement and potentially join forces with some of the existing puppet opposition parties like Sergei Mironov's Just Russia. Remember, Prigozhin didn't want to oppose Putin's political system or take it down. He just wanted to establish himself as its respected member. But before any of this could materialize, Prigozhin saw Wagner being wrestled away from him. In June 2023, Putin ordered all Wagner mercenaries to sign an official contract with the Russian Ministry of Defense and become part of regular Russian forces. This effectively meant the end of Prigozhin's control over Wagner and possibly the end of Wagner itself. But most importantly, it meant that Prigozhin lost in his conflict with the Ministry of Defense, and this was something he found very difficult to swallow. He got so blinded by his hate towards Shoigu and Gerasimov, as well as his perceived invincibility, he decided he was ready to actually challenge the Kremlin. At the end of June, he faked the bombing of a Wagner camp, blamed the Ministry of Defense, and announced that Wagner was marching on Moscow to punish those responsible. While he framed this march as being primarily against the leadership of the army and not Putin, it was very clear that Prigozhin started a military coup. Before the Kremlin could do anything about it, Wagner took over Rostov-on-Don, a large city in southern Russia. In the city, he met with two senior army officials, Deputy Defense Minister and Deputy Army Chief, and he made them look like two confused little boys being scolded by their teacher. This initial negotiation didn't really lead anywhere, and the Wagner troops continued their movement towards Moscow, shooting down several Russian military planes and helicopters along the way. They soon reached another large city, Voronezh, but decided to go around it. While the majority then continued to march north towards Moscow, a small group broke off and headed east of Voronezh, possibly, and this is huge, to capture a Russian military base with nuclear weapons. All of this sent waves of panic and caused absolute chaos in the Russian political establishment. Everyone started running around trying to slow down the Wagner troops. Roads were being blocked with whatever the local authorities could find, from buses to road maintenance vehicles. In some instances, the Russian military actually bombed the roads without any previous warning, causing injuries to civilians. And Moscow was literally being prepared for war, as the Russian military was reportedly planning to blow up main bridges on the way to the capital. Putin, who was visibly shaken, published a speech in which he accused Prigozhin and Wagner of treason. Prigozhin, in turn, said that Putin was deeply mistaken, and Wagner's telegram channels claimed that soon Russia was going to have a new president. The confusion and complete paralysis of the state in response to Prigozhin's mutiny exposed the real weakness of Putin's regime. It showed that this seemingly powerful authoritarian state crumbles the moment it faces a serious challenge. It almost looked like the Russian security apparatus is powerful only when it comes to beating up unarmed protesters and wiping poison on people's underwear. But when several thousands of armed soldiers led by a former criminal decided to actually challenge Putin's power, the entire system suddenly found itself inches away from a total collapse. I mean, it even became a running joke that before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Russian military was considered the second strongest in the world. After the invasion, it suddenly became second strongest in Ukraine, and after Prigozhin's mutiny, second strongest even in Russia. Of course, this is an exaggeration. The element of surprise obviously played a massive role here. And once the Russian state got out of the initial shock, it became highly unlikely that Prigozhin's coup would have succeeded. The Russian military might have been weakened by the war in Ukraine, but realistically it would still take more than several thousands of Wagner mercenaries to capture a city like Moscow. Even if Wagner reached the suburbs of the capital, they would simply get stuck there and likely eventually obliterated by the Russian aviation. It would then take a lot of bloodshed and fighting inside Rostov to push the remaining Wagner forces out of the city, but certainly not an impossible task for the Russian military. And Prigozhin obviously knew this too. However, what he placed his bets on was that he would get a lot of support from Russian soldiers, officers and generals, many of whom also hated the defense minister Shoigu and wanted to get rid of him. Most notably, Prigozhin relied on General Sergei Surovikin, who briefly led Russia's war in Ukraine and had allegedly known about Prigozhin's plans. But when none of the representatives of the Russian army backed him up, Prigozhin understood that his chances of success were incredibly low. He knew he'd lost, and so, naturally, he started looking for an emergency way out via negotiations with the Kremlin. And just like that, around 24 hours after the start of the rebellion, Prigozhin announced that an agreement was reached and that Wagner was turning its troops around. The entire military coup attempt was suddenly over, leaving everyone wondering what the hell just happened. The agreement was allegedly brokered by the self-proclaimed president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko. He guaranteed the safety of Prigozhin and his troops and offered them to station themselves in Belarus after the mutiny. While Lukashenko, as comical as ever, tried to make himself look very important, it was obvious that he was nothing more than Putin's messenger in this story. Having received certain security guarantees, Prigozhin and Wagner left Rostov. Right after the mutiny, the attitude of the Russian state in relation to Prigozhin was a bit ambiguous. On the one hand, several days after the rebellion, Prigozhin and the main Wagner commanders allegedly met with Putin in the Kremlin. This suggested that the mutineers may have been forgiven and the conflict might have been resolved. Additionally, Wagner allegedly continued to recruit new members after the attempted coup. On the other hand, Russian authorities went after Prigozhin's assets. His main media outlets were all shut down and his offices in St. Petersburg were raided by the security services. Prigozhin's mansion was also searched and the photos were leaked to the media. Apart from the tasteless interior design of a typical gangster from the 90s Russia, the photos also showed Prigozhin's weapons, gold bars, a wardrobe full of wigs, and a framed photo of severed heads of Wagner's enemies in Africa. Russian media also published bizarre selfies of Prigozhin in various disguises, wearing fake beards, glasses, wigs, and uniforms, which he likely used during Wagner's operations in the Middle East and Africa. The selfies were ridiculous, and the security services clearly leaked them to publicly humiliate Prigozhin. Despite all these photos being leaked and widely discussed, Prigozhin decided to avoid publicity for a while. Nobody really knew much regarding his whereabouts until mid-July, when he appeared on a video giving a speech at a Wagner camp in Belarus, preparing his mercenaries to new missions in Africa. At the end of July, he also attended the Russia-Africa Economic Forum in St. Petersburg, where he met with the representatives of the Central African Republic. He then also released a video from an unspecified African country in August, essentially trying to show that it was business as usual for Wagner. It almost seemed like Prigozhin was forgiven by Putin as he continued to freely travel to and from Russia. Knowing Putin and how vengeful he is, many people were surprised to see Prigozhin walk free after his mutiny and believed the story was far from over. An investigative journalist, Christo Groze, for example, gave an interview to the Financial Times in which he predicted that Prigozhin was either going to be killed or there was going to be another coup. And on the 24th of August, exactly 2 months after Prigozhin's rebellion, his business jet crashed on its way from Moscow to St. Petersburg. Prigozhin died in the crash alongside Wagner's commander Utkin and 8 other victims, 3 of which were the flight crew and had nothing to do with Wagner. Right after the crash, numerous different speculations and conspiracy theories emerged about it, as they usually do in Russia. But it couldn't be more obvious that this was a very public execution of Prigozhin. It was clear that Putin assassinated him to take revenge for the humiliation that Prigozhin's rebellion has caused him, and also to remind the members of the Russian political elite what happens to people who betray him. In October 2023, Putin has rather cynically commented on Prigozhin's death. He basically claimed that the Wagner leaders blew up the plane by themselves with a hand grenade and implied that they may have been on drugs. Since this was a public execution, I honestly don't think Putin tried very hard to make this version sound believable. And I think it's needless to say that it was a complete nonsense. As the Wall Street Journal later reported, Russia's security services likely inserted an explosive device into Prigozhin's jet during its pre-departure safety checks. The entire assassination was reportedly organized by Putin's close ally and the head of Russia's Security Council, Nikolai Patrushev. According to many experts, Prigozhin's fate was sealed the moment he agreed to wrap up his rebellion. Putin considered him a traitor, and that's essentially a death sentence in today's Russia. But what remains a mystery is how could Prigozhin fall into this trap? How could he trust Putin that he would let him live? I mean, it is quite possible that he just simply didn't have a choice. But if there's anything that we should take away from the end of Prigozhin's story, it's that only a fool can trust Putin. And that's it from me for today. If you enjoy this podcast, please make sure you give it 5 stars on relevant streaming platforms, click the follow button and recommend it to your friends. As always, thank you for listening to Post-Soviet Chronicles.